I'm just going to get started, and before I introduce our next speaker, I would like to share a few things about her. Right before high school, Cheryl Cummings contracted encephalitis and became blind. Cheryl had to learn how to read Braille and how to get around the cane. She received tremendous support from many people and was able to graduate high school, as well as continue her education at Princeton University, where she received a degree in international relations. The year following college was extremely busy for Cheryl. She found time to pursue a graduate degree at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts, and she also spent 2 years in the Peace Corps working at the Department of Special Education in the Dominican Republic. After graduate school in the Peace Corps, Cheryl worked for 8 years at the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, where she performed community outreach and led the agency's diversity efforts. After many years of working in the community, it was apparent to Cheryl that there were still obstacles to overcome, particularly those encountered by blind children, as well as the unacceptable high unemployment rate within the blindness community. As a result, in 2005, Cheryl started Our Space, Our Place. Our Space, Our Place provides a year-round after-school and career exploration program to blind youth between the ages of 8 and 21. Our Space, Our Place is housed at the Tobin Community Center in Roxbury. Society needs more people like Cheryl who see a need and then address the need head on. It gives me great pleasure to introduce the founder and board president of Our Space, Our Place, Cheryl Cummings.
Thank you all for coming. I don't actually have a lot to say because I figured you're really here to hear from the Fidelity folks and to learn about what they're doing and how this can help you as you think about what you wanted to do. I just wanted to say in particular thank you to Glenn and to Leanne and to everyone from Fidelity who listened to our request to hold this event and were generous in helping us plan it and organize it and helping us to make it function. As Glenn said, Our Space, Our Place is a nonprofit. We've been around for 5 years. And in addition to this particular event, we're hoping that we will plan some other similar types of events across Boston. And I hope you'll all be interested and join us with those. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Glenn and open up the afternoon. Thank you all for coming.
Okay, so it gives me great pleasure to introduce our premier panel.
My name is Nina Marshudi, and I work here at Fidelity. I'm a public relations manager, and I work in a group called Marketing Communications. And what we do in that group is really basically try to pitch stories to the media about the things that are happening here at Fidelity. So with any new product launch that we may have within a business or any good stories that we want to tell, we sort of use our group to create the material, write the message, talk to our executives about what we want them to be communicating out to reporters, and then we sort of push out the information in the form of media material, which can be print documents, they can be videos with our executives on camera. So there are a bunch of different elements that go into what we do. I work on one side, which is primarily charged with creating the material. So I do a lot of writing, a lot of strategizing on our approach, on how we're going to, which sort of reporters we're going to go to, how we're going to approach them, what our top messages are, what we want to be communicating out. So that's primarily what I do here. I went to Northeastern University. That's where I got my education, and I was a broadcast journalism major, so I have sort of that background. I worked in broadcast journalism for almost 4 years after I graduated at one of the local TV stations. And originally, you know, before I went to college, I had already always wanted to be a filmmaker, so that was sort of my passion, and I thought I would do that until my mother told me I'd end up a waitress in California. So quickly, after I entered university, I decided, you know, broadcast journalism might be sort of the best of both worlds, so I worked in that field and then flipped over to public relations after the broadcast journalism stint at one of the local stations. I started working for a local hospital here in Boston and doing PR for them, and that's really where I learned how to do public relations and how to sort of communicate and how to switch the message from being someone who was receiving those communications from various people to sort of presenting it to the media. And then after that, I found an opportunity here at Fidelity doing something very similar with a company that does something that I was very unfamiliar with. I was not a business major. I didn't really know much about finance. So it was a huge learning curve and a lot to sort of take in the beginning. But so now I'm basically doing PR for the company here at Fidelity.
I'm Don Messier. I work for the internal advertising agency of Fidelity. Fidelity as an external agency, and then as the internal agency. my group, my department, is in charge of video production here. We do a lot of videotapes. We do a lot of meetings and events. We host. We have a team that also supports large events like this and larger throughout the country for customers. You know, I've been doing television for a long time. When I was younger, I never thought I would be doing this. I thought I'd be a doctor. Wow. When I went to college, I went to Boston College. I was always good in math. I was great in science. Sometime in my second year, I decided that, boy, I really don't like the science. Even if I could do it, I was really bored. I couldn't be interested, so I was smart enough to change. And I studied economics. I studied psychology. And I always took advantage of opportunities to do different things. In high school, we had a radio station that was being built, and I was able to join and participate in that. And I did a nice job, and I was interested. And when I went to college, I had to work to help pay my college bills. And my first job was in the kitchen, and we were cleaning dishes. And I said, boy, I'd like to see if there was something more interesting. And they had an audiovisual department and a television studio. I worked there. I did that for my entire 4 years of college, and I liked it. And so I decided that after school, I worked for a year, and they offered me a graduate assistant to study education and how video and technology could be used to enhance the educational experience. So that's how I started in my career. And, you know, I loved it. I love communicating. I love designing messages. I'm almost a filmmaker. And having that experience and being able to do it for a company like Fidelity has been tremendous. You know, Fidelity is an organization that if you see a need, you can find a, if you can propose a solution, they have to let you try it. Successful, you get to do it over and over again. And when people come and visit my department, they tell us that we have the greatest job in the world because we have fun, we get to create, we get to build things. It's really a tremendous opportunity and enjoy it tremendously.
So hello again, my name is Leah. I'm director of catering at the Seaport Hotel and World Trade Center. A lot of times when you think of Fidelity, you don't necessarily think of a hotel, but the Seaport is a Fidelity Capital company. I was a major in hospitality when I was a kid growing up. My dad used to travel about 250 days out of the year, so I spent a lot of school vacations and summer vacations traveling with him, going to hotels, and I was that girl that was always peeking in the ballrooms, looking at the parties, peeking at the weddings, and I was very into planning my own birthday parties when I was a little kid. I did not care if I got any presents. What I wanted was everybody to have a great experience. I went to New Hampshire College at the time, and I majored in tourism management and hotel restaurant management, even though I really wanted to be a party planner. That was not a major that is as popular as it is right now. A lot of major colleges and universities that have hospitality programs now actually have a major where you can specialize in meetings and events. So for me, my career path, I started with the Seaport in 1999. It was my first job out of college, and I started as an administrative assistant in the sales office. And that was great exposure for me because I was able to work with our director of catering, which is the position that I hold now, and the senior catering manager. I'm working with the types of events that we do. And one of the big focuses and something that my family spent a lot of time with when I was growing up with was nonprofits. And in my role right now, even though I work for a for-profit company, I specialize in nonprofit galas. We've had Perkins with us doing their gala that was a fundraising event a couple of years ago, which is a great opportunity for me to work with a nonprofit and help them structure their event to raise funds and awareness. But also my role is to provide experiences. And one of the things that we really look at is how can we take somebody, what is their vision, what are they trying to accomplish, whether it's Fidelity hosting a business meeting that's communicating information about a new product, or whether it's one of Don's great videos, or whether it's something that Kim does, which is recognizing employees' accomplishments. I have the ability to work with people to make that happen. I oversee in my role the corporate catering sales team, so we book holiday parties, we book fundraisers, and I also work with the wedding team, which everybody loves weddings. So I like to say that I'm a career party girl, but not the same way as Paris Hilton. And working at an independent hotel has been wonderful for me because unlike working at some of the corporate chains where there's a very strict set of policies and procedures, we have a lot of creativity and flexibility, and I think Don touched on that. But if you see an opportunity, if you see a solution, or for me, food is very trendy right now. Service is very trendy right now. Living like you're living in a hotel is very trendy right now. So when we're doing a renovation at the hotel, or when we're buying new china, or buying new flatware, or designing new menus, we can look at what's fun and fabulous, and how can we translate that and make that work for a party of 4, 40, 400, or 4,000 people?
Thanks, Leah. My name is Kim Riley, and I am in the corporate events group at Fidelity. I've been with that group for 12 years. It's the first job I took with Fidelity, and I'm still in the same group because it is such an exciting job. I work often with Leah and Don, collaborating on event design. Within the group I'm in, we manage a lot of the employee initiatives, which are either the holiday events or a celebration of service. Once an employee reaches 10 years with Fidelity, they're invited to a service event, and we manage those across the country. So there's 12 different sites from here to Albuquerque, New Mexico, that we manage these events for. But it's all about creating a memorable experience for them and creating fun and interactive elements. So I truly enjoy my job. I've had the pleasure of working with so many different business groups at Fidelity and watching it grow over the years. You know, it's always something new. Every year we're working on something new. My background is also hospitality. I went to Johnson & Wales University, which is in Providence. At the time, they did not have a meetings and events degree, so I took a hospitality degree, and I began my work in hotels. I was with the Sonesta Hotel here in Cambridge, and then I was with Starwood Hotels for several years. And that actually is what brought me to Fidelity. It was a connection through the Starwood Hotel I was working at, and that brought me to Fidelity. So it's a very exciting role. It's a lot of work. There's a lot of travel. There's always something new. You know, I come into the each day with a list of things I'm going to get done, and typically don't get any of them done because something else comes up. So it's ever changing. And that's it. Alicia?
Hi, everyone. I'm Alicia Cable Watts, and you may hear Abel, which is my partner here, Tico. She's just from the CNI school, and I've had her for the past almost 9 years. I've been at Fidelity probably, if you add up everybody's year on this panel, it might get close to how long I've been here. It's almost 26 years. I like to tell everybody I started when I was 10 years old. My problem is I have to keep having to reduce the age as I stay here longer and longer. I've actually had a few careers here at Fidelity. I started out as a budget analyst in our real estate group. So I learned a lot about real estate, buying and selling buildings, and creating leases for tenants. And then had the opportunity to manage people as their accounting manager. And then moved over. We have a corporate group where it's more centralized functions that touch the many businesses that we have. It was there that, Mia, I think, I went over to the Fidelity Capital Companies, which I think is a real fun place because I had the opportunity there, using my finance and accounting background, to be a part of creating a business. If you're in a small business or sort of a family-owned business, you get a chance to do a lot of different things. There's not a high, the more complex, where you have multiple roles and people have deep expertise. And in that role, I had the opportunity to travel to various places in Asia and in Europe, as well as things that I never would have thought I would work on, things like building the hotel and some of the office buildings we own. And I didn't exactly swing a sledgehammer, but I did have a hard hat. And it was just a great experience. Part of a place like Fidelity allows you the opportunity to test out your potential and to not necessarily study one thing and follow a linear track. As Don mentioned, he starts thinking he's going to be a doctor. And look where he is now. And the idea that Fidelity has opportunities for someone who loves TV or loves parties or events is just amazing. And then 13 years ago, I lost my sight. So I took about a year and a half and went through a rehab program and went to seeing eye school to get a dog. And then it was like I was starting over a bit where I had to interview to find a position that I could do. At first, I thought, well, what can I do being limited by not having sight? And because of the openness of the leaders here at Fidelity and probably my own stubbornness and tenacity, we started to look at various opportunities. And it wasn't a perfect fit on day one. I started with a group in the finance world because we have a finance background, so you can work in the finance group and that would be easy. And it wasn't as easy as they said it was going to be. To be honest, Even though I studied finance and accounting in college, and I have an analytical thought process, and I like the clean preciseness of numbers, I really had a passion around working with people in teams and a curiosity around backgrounds and experiences other people had, either different cultures or just different lifestyles. With that always in the back of my mind, I was always open to opportunities where roles and projects I could incorporate that. And so I started out in the newly formed e-business group when they centralized all of the e-business separate from the technology group. And I am not a technologist, but I did learn about HTML languages and coding and tagging and meta tags and some of the other words that true technology web designers use. But even though I had no background in training, and to be honest with you, not a deep passionate interest in how codes are arrived at and designed, I was able to use my interests and my strengths around partnering with people and listening to them to work on a project team, which was the first start of introducing the idea of accessibility on the web. And again, this was over 10 years ago, and it's come so far now in Anne-Marie's and Tom's and Marguerite's group. And then as I got more comfortable with using the software of JAWS and interacting with people and subtly educating them on the potential and the possibilities and the creative ways that someone who can't see can do things in a very sighted world, people were more open. And I often joke, I can't tell you how many times people apologize to me because they forget I can't see. And they're pointing to something, and then they're in their mind, they're saying, why isn't she looking? And I think that that's a great compliment rather than a need for an apology. After the technology group, I was able to get into an HR, a human resource function, which was much more aligned with my interests, my passions, and where I have skills through understanding how human resources works in this company. And then the different aspects of that, I, 6 years ago, went into a leadership development group, which really works across the whole company to work with people at all levels of their leadership and their experience to make them better and to have them recognize their own strengths and how they can use those strengths to be great leaders. Within that group, about 2.5 years ago, a program was developed, and it's called the General Management Apprenticeship Program. And in this program, there are apprentices who most have college and graduate degrees, not always in finance or accounting. Some had hospitality experience. Some were in the military, and they were overseas, or they trained in various sites here. You know, some were in technology and wanted a broader view of Fidelity, and they were interested in other aspects. What I get the chance to do, and I don't even call it a job because it doesn't feel like one, because I love it so much, is I coach these individual young, soon-to-be leaders over 2 years and build their own self-awareness and an appreciation of their own skills and how to work on those areas that may be a little frightening. Many of the things, whether you're an apprentice or a high school student or a college student, I think every single one of us inside is a little nervous to take a step out of our comfort zone. And knowing that we all have the ability to take that step and make something happen is a great gift to give yourselves. And when I get nervous about something, I usually say, well, what's the worst that can happen? And usually it's I get lost, or I think of some place where I'm not, or I say something to someone who's actually talking on a cell phone and not to me. A little embarrassment, but nothing all that bad that should prevent me from giving it a try. That's my my story at Fidelity. I grew up here in a little south of Boston and went to Boston College. I had my finance and accounting degree and started on that linear path of this is what I study, so this must be what I work in, and ended up where I am now. I did this team building once where everyone around the room had to say, what did your parents want you to be as you were growing up? And what were their hopes? And some of the answers were pretty amazing. And when it came to me, I thought, all my mother ever said was, have a job so you can afford to travel and take care of yourself and be happy. And it didn't matter what it was. So I didn't necessarily plan all the experiences I've had or even imagine I was going to have any of them. But I feel very fortunate.
Thank you. We should give a round of applause to our parents. Your turn. You have in front of you a rich variety of five people who have experiences from writing to public relations to commercials and TV production, catering, food services, event management, finances, accounting, and leadership. If you are interested in asking a question, if you put your hand up, one of us will come over to you, we'll tap you on the shoulder, and we'll hand you a microphone.
Some people would say that working in a place that is all about finance wouldn't be, you know, the most interesting thing in the world. What would you say to those people?
I'd say they're definitely wrong. Right? They are really wrong. It's so interesting to learn all the different things that Fidelity does. Leah had mentioned how we own a hotel, and she runs that. So there are so many different things that this company does that I've been to places to do video productions on a tomato farm to the trading floor. And we've been to the hotel many times. And not only that, it's really what you bring to your job every day that helps make it interesting. It's really up to each of us as employees to impact how the company moves forward. And we all have a say in that. We have the ability to make our jobs interesting. That's what I get to do every day. It's like, how can we do this differently? How do you make this program look different than every other financial program that we've done in the past? And we take that as a challenge, and we apply ourselves to that. And that's what makes us get up and come to work every day.
My question is for the media guy. How do you decide TV versus radio? How does that work?
That's a very good question. A lot of it is by what are the objectives of this deliverable. So if I have a communication that is targeted to display something, then the natural fit is to put that on television because it's easier to show something than it is to explain it. For the radio programming that we've done is they're usually shorter in duration and not a lot of information unless we're trying to put almost a book on tape type of program where somebody can sit and listen to a presentation or a program in their car. That's not what we usually are designing for. So most of the work that comes into my department, it is fit for the television screen.
Also for the media guy, what presentation can you listen to on any radio station?
For Fidelity, we've done a number of interpretations of brochures that are read so that people can listen to them. We also have a lot of presentations that are typically used in training where a salesperson or a subject matter expert will make a presentation that will be recorded and then distributed in an audio format so that somebody can listen to it on their iPod and their car radios. They have the ability to take that information. We also take some of the financial presentations and make them available on the website via audio files so that they can be downloaded as a podcast to the iPods.
How do you get an apprentice to Fidelity?
How do you get an apprentice? We have, if someone internal, someone that wants to go into the program, we have an internal website where we'll send out a message to everybody saying the opportunity to apply, and then there's an application process. And external, we have a wonderful staffing organization where they go and recruit at colleges where there are graduate students getting ready to graduate. And they have, I don't know if you've ever been to kind of like a fair, so different companies, different organizations will have booths, and they'll talk about their company for the opportunities. And then sometimes it's through a friend of a friend. Someone might say, well, I know about this program, you'd be perfect in it, and you apply. You go through an application process, and then depending on how many people apply, whether it's everybody gets an opportunity or they
they have to shrink the numbers, you'll come in for an interview. And usually we have many more people, qualified people that apply, and we can only take a certain number to work with. So the interview process is over a few week period. And then if you're selected, you get a letter or a phone call. And if you're not, you have feedback from one of the recruiters or the interview people as to maybe what you need to build in skills or what was missing or why it wouldn't be a good fit.
Alicia, if somebody wanted to apply to Fidelity in this room for an internship, what would you recommend?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you, if it goes through staffing, but usually if you know anybody or you have a contact to apply, and I know Fidelity works with various organizations to look for interns, like summer interns.
I was like wondering what the like phone number was for like public relations here.
Oh, for public relations? We have actually a general phone number, so we get so many calls to Fidelity every day from just journalists. So there's a separate number for customers to call if they have a problem or issue with their account, but we also have a dedicated number for journalists to call, and we have a whole department staffed with people who decide what to do with those phone calls. So depending on what the nature of the call is like, who they're looking to speak with, what they want to find out more about, we sort of take that call, and they'll tell the appropriate person, and then we sort of get in touch with that business unit and say, hey, you know, so-and-so from the Wall Street Journal or this reporter from the Boston Globe wants to talk to you about this new product that you just announced last week. And then we connect them and we put them in touch. You know, a lot of times, you know, we'll just get on the phone with our business folks and just sort of refresh them on some of the top key messages. So that they're saying the right things on the phone to the journalist, and then we just connect the two.
I assume that Fidelity has a statement about being inclusionary with a diverse workforce, and two parts to my question. One is there specifically identified in that disabled people? And secondly, how do you see that reflected in your hiring practices? How often are disabled recruited and hired, and what sort of accommodations have you seen for them?
So I'm wondering if I put Barney on the spot. Do you know by any chance? And the only reason I asked was a couple of years ago, I was on an accessibility committee, and we may not have a good answer for you, but we can get back to you with a good answer.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what processes are currently in place, but I do know at other companies they have very well-defined processes for where they actively recruit folks with various abilities to come in and work. We have worked with HR sort of on the tail end of that process, where if someone needs accommodation because, you know, all of a sudden they develop carpal tunnel or they're losing their vision, we'll go in and get a sense for what they need from a technology standpoint and then make recommendations around that. Talk to them about the kinds of training that's available, work with their managers to make sure that they can procure the assistive software if it's needed and things of that nature. But as far as a fully formed program, I'm not sure that one exists currently.
I know that I've been here 10 years, and I was in the communications arena for a number of years, and we ran programs, and at the end of every program, I had to send a transcript out to a number of hearing-impaired people because they couldn't hear it. So we immediately have somebody transcribe it, and we send it right to them. So I know that I used to work with a guy who had a voice box, so I know that Fidelity hires people with diverse backgrounds, but I don't know the official policy. I'm pretty sure if you go to Fidelity.com, there must be something stated there, but we can absolutely get back to you with a more solid answer.
Well, I don't know that there's an exact policy carving it out, but we are open. It's not that people are turned away or whatever. I've worked in a number of groups since I've been back after losing my sight. I know that there are people in some phone sites that have visual impairments that have been hired. I know that, you know, I've had phone calls from managers from different areas of the company that says, I'm getting prepared to introduce a new employee. They have a vision impairment. Can you help guide me into how to make sure I've got all the accommodations and the propriety and that? A relatively new group in Fidelity is our diversity group, which is young and they're just developing their mission and their website and is reaching out. I don't think it's gone far enough yet to have a focus on disabled. It's really, diversity is all about differences.
For the home cows,
Were you a concierge?
No, actually, in high school, my first job in a hotel was being a PBX operator, which is one of the most challenging jobs at the hotel because you never know until you've worked there for a while when somebody's on the other line calling for somebody if they're a guest or an employee because there's so many different roles in the hotel. So my first job in a hotel was actually working as an operator, and then I worked at the front desk, not as a concierge. To be a concierge is actually a lot of training, and there's actually a concierge organization for master concierge, which takes years of experience and has a lot to do with really knowing the ins and outs of everything about the area. And then my third job in a hotel where I started at Seaport was working as an administrative assistant in the sales office. The one thing about the hotel industry that's very unusual, it's still one of the only industries in the world, I think, where you can start at any level and may or may not have education in that's a major and work your way up to the top, because a lot of it really has to do with experience and it has to do with your passion for people and your energy. We have a saying in the hospitality industry that you should be able to hear somebody smile over the phone. And that's something that you can't teach. It's something that's born. You know, that's something I think that's really unique about my field.
Also, for Starwood, you said you worked for Bayer.
Yeah, my background, just like Leah's, is hotels as well. And I began in the restaurant business. I was a hostess and a server.
I happen to live near a Starwood hotel myself.
Oh, good. Which one?
The Meridian.
Oh, right. In here in Boston, or...
I'm in Cambridge.
In Cambridge, yep. And the Meridian hotels are just new to the Starwood family a few years ago. They're a chain of hotels that continue to grow. They have different brands of hotels, and they're still adding different brands.
What do you guys do with technology?
In television, it's all about technology, right? So right now, we're on a path to migrate to the high-definition format for video production. We have all kinds of desktop audio editing tools now with Pro Tools, and everything is migrating to smaller and smaller platforms, all being done on the computer, so our edit systems are all desktop now. Years ago, you'd have to have a big room to fill with all the equipment that you needed to put together a television show. Now you can do it on a laptop. Everything's getting smaller, and then the distribution channels for what we produce has changed. It used to be tape or DVD or over the airways, and now it's, you know, over the internet, and more content is being delivered online, and people are interacting with it in different ways, so that it's no longer a video or film that used to always be, you start at the beginning of the program and you go to the end of the program, and that's how you consume that content. You watched it through. Now you interact with it and you engage with it, and it can ask you questions, and then depending on your answer, it can bring you to a different part of that program. That's what we're doing with that technology, and so my craft is changing now. What it used to be, and instead of thinking in a linear plane, we have to think in all different dimensions. If you were to decide that you wanted to learn more about bonds instead of stocks, I want to take you to that part of the program so that you can interact with that. Or if you wanted to learn more about zoology, and we wanted to be able to make you go where you wanted to be engaged. And people are consuming content much shorter bites now, so we have to think about that in packaging.
Can I add to that? The building that you're sitting in right here at 245 Summer Street houses Fidelity Center for Advanced Technology. And later on today, someone's going to be speaking about that, because we're constantly testing new technology before we bring it out to the consumers. So it's one of Fidelity's strengths.
And if I can add too, I think technology too is also expanded now to social media and social networking. For me, in the hotel side of things, I've done a lot of events lately where we have plasma screens where people are doing a live Twitter feed in the party and talking about that. Our hotel, you know, has fans on Facebook, and we put updates on there every single day. We generate business, we generate opportunities, and we also, you know, there's a new application on Facebook where you can check in at a specific restaurant, bar, or venue. A lot of people are using that, so it's a completely different way to get exposure and information and also have experiences. And I think that I'm seeing that, you know, develop and change as we do business, as we make contacts, but also as it relates to events.
And that, if I can add to that as well, also on the public relations front, we're sort of finding new ways to push information out. So we also have a Fidelity Facebook page where we will post product announcements, anything we push out to the media. We're also posting on our Fidelity page as well, and we're getting fans and have people kind of posting on the wall and asking various questions, and we have a whole team of people dedicated to responding to those folks. And we also have a Twitter page as well, so we're also, in our news releases that we send out to the media, we'll also do like a quick snippet on Twitter and Facebook as well.
Add to that, someone said to me the other day, is Fidelity a technology company that does financial stuff or a finance company that does technology stuff? Because it's such a huge part, and there's the web technology and the Fidelity.com, and then there's the technology that many of us use to do our jobs, the internal. And I use JAWS as my accessibility software, and as many of you probably know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But the adaptability, even when I work with outside vendors and having to read their reports, part of it is being creative yourself. Okay, I can't read this graph. Can I get the information in another format so that I can do my job? And you'll find that many vendors, as well as internal Fidelity, once they become aware that what they see is not necessarily what someone may hear or what someone may be able to navigate around for whatever reason, they're very open. We have a lot of very intelligent people in the technology. They care, number one, and they want to help, and two, they're curious. They're intelligent, so they're curious as to how the software works or what they can do to make it work.
Putting you on the spot, whether Fidelity or otherwise in your careers, have you ever worked directly with a person who has any kind of a physical challenge whatsoever within a department that you're at or a place of employment that you were at? If yes, what was the challenge that person had or disability? What did you take from it that was positive? And then following up with that with Alicia, as an employee currently who has a disability, if you were telling entry people, whether they came to Fidelity or anywhere else, what to look for in an employer, going to an employer and having a disability walking in the door, what would you tell them to look for?
I have not had the experience of working with someone with a disability. I worked for a TV station right out of the gate and then for a hospital. So actually at the hospital, I think I did work with some people with disabilities there as well. But they were more volunteers than coworkers of mine who were there 24/7. You know, I find that regardless of ability or disability, I always learn something from everyone I interact with. And I feel like everyone I work with sort of has something to bring to the table, regardless of whether or not they have a disability. Here at Fidelity, I work with sort of a smaller group, and no one in my current group has a disability.
I've worked early in my career with somebody who was hearing impaired, and it was only for a short time. You know, the first thing I thought was, boy, this may be a challenge, but, you know, I quickly dismissed that because this person was so outgoing and dedicated and supportive and offered so much that communication was not difficult at all. You know, I found it a very, very rewarding experience. Outside of work, I'm a skier, and I do ski patrol. I've had the opportunity many times to work with both visually impaired skiers and physically impaired skiers, and I'm absolutely amazed, impressed how they work, how their disabled athletes perform and excel. I'm looking forward to going when they have the Special Olympics. You know, part of my team that I work with, they go up north and we do the Special Olympics, and it's my goal to go on that trip this year because I found it a wonderful, wonderful experience.
From my perspective, I've not had any media colleagues that have disabilities. However, I do a lot of events in which people with a variety of abilities attend. I used to do a lot of work with a spinal cord injury group, and we would do their event every single year. So in terms of experiences and what I focus on, making sure that that experience was comfortable. You know, if it was a guest in a wheelchair, that we would have tables with play settings that, you know, didn't have a chair there, so there wasn't any lag in service. There wasn't any, you know, accommodations that needed to be made on the spot, so it was very seamless for them to come and experience the evening. We've made special parking and arrangement informations, but also looked at our food and beverage service and changed the configuration of some of our auction tables using lower tables, changing the configuration of our bars so that they'd be more accessible. And I think that was very eye-opening for us because it is something that you take for granted. If I can come in and get serviced on a bar that's at a specific height, but if a guest is in a chair, if a guest has a different type of impairment, department, that's something that's a learning opportunity. And, you know, for me in my industry, those learning opportunities don't ever stop. Every opportunity, I had a guest this week that came in that had a severe back injury, and the accommodations that we needed to make for the chair for her to be able to sit through the evening's program was something that I had not encountered before. Now it's something that myself and my team have had that experience, and the next time we encounter a guest with a similar issue, we'll be able to address it comfortably and make sure that they have the best experience.
I personally did work with someone, actually, when I was at one of the Starwood hotels out in San Francisco. One of my colleagues in the sales group I was in was paralyzed from the legs down, so he was in a wheelchair. And I think what it did is just it taught me a lot about just patience. And in watching him, he was so eager and persistent to just do what everybody else was doing. You know, I think it opened your eyes to the fact that just because they're in a chair, it doesn't mean they can't do what I'm doing. So, you know, it's a good learning experience.
I'm going to answer both questions, if that's okay. I have worked with two individuals stick out in my mind. They didn't work for Fidelity, but they were partners in some of the work I was doing. And one was a senior auditor at one of the major accounting firms. And I worked with him, and he didn't have an arm underneath his elbow. It just didn't stop him, not from anything. And it was like, I wouldn't have known. And the second one, I was actually traveling, and I was really nervous because I had never, I don't know anything about international taxes, and I was meeting with someone over in Taiwan to help work on a contract. And I was in their boardroom in law offices, especially major international ones. It's all like overwhelming, you know, this big long mahogany table and oriental rugs and everything. And the partner came in a wheelchair. And at first I wanted to say, are you okay? And I wanted to try to help, but he didn't need any help. And it was just a reminder to me that people do things in different ways, and it's not necessarily any less or more than any of us. And I bet that there's been a bunch of people I've worked with disabilities that I'm not even aware of. And I think the second question was what to look for in an employer if you're interviewing. For me personally, it's in the dialogue, the openness, and they're asking what I or the individual would need for accommodations. You know, some people would say it's nice to know if they have anybody or other people that have disabilities, and I think that that could be helpful only in understanding, is there some awareness already there? But to evaluate, you know, within the dialogue and the research, are they familiar with disabilities? And then that gives you the sense of how much education over and above your job that you'll bring into the environment. Actually, an additional responsibility that may not be in the job description. A lot of people will judge a group based on a small number of people. So I would like to think that people that have worked with me are more open to the potential of people with a sight impairment or other disabilities because of my interaction and how I can either reach out for help and assistance in the right way or not rely on a disability as a crutch.
In your presentation today, it sounded like everybody started here in positions after they had at least finished college. I'm wondering if you could give us some idea of entry-level positions with a high school diploma, what opportunities there are within Fidelity for somebody coming in at that level.
I had a developer who came in who knew Flash, which is the Flash program, and he could program in Flash, and he had actually a GED, so he had dropped out of high school. But he knew the product, he could design interfaces and make what I consider magic happen with what we needed to do. So the one thing I would say about education, it's a door opener, it's a conversation starter. But experience and opportunities is really what happens. And, you know, the opportunities get us into the experience. And I say this to my kids that they're so tired of hearing it now. But, you know, I always tried to live by it. You know, any opportunity that came my way, I always tried to do the best I could. I absolutely always did the best I could, and I always tried to exceed everybody's expectations. And what I found by doing that is it gave me more opportunities. This gentleman who came in and did some work with us, that's exactly what he did. He latched onto something that he loved to do, and he worked at it very, very hard, and he did a lot of that work on his own, and then he proved that he could do it, and he excelled at it. He's off at another company now doing it. I'm wishing he was still here. You know, it just shows you that every time that somebody gave him something and it was a challenge, even though he never did it before and never saw it, he would research it, he would work at it, and he would come back with a solution. And 9 times out of 10, that was better than what he could have imagined it would have been. And that would be the advice I would give to everybody. You know, whatever you do, whatever you have, you know, the first job I had was working in a delicatessen cleaning up. At the end of the week, they had pallets on the floor that they used to throw sawdust on to keep all the stuff. My job was to clean those pallets. I did the best I could, and I cleaned them so that they were very, very clean. That gave me other opportunities in that place. So I would just say that that's what we should try to do.
I would add to that and just say the number one thing that I would advise you to do is always ask. It never hurts to ask. I used to sort of be fearful when I was in school, oh, I'll never get that internship. That's a tough internship to get, or that's a place I could never work at. And you'd be surprised by just asking how much you can achieve just by that one simple thing, is just making that first step and saying, hey, is this something that I can do, and asking. And also, you know, the opportunities that present themselves when you do things like internships are worth so much, and they have been in my experience in particular. They opened doors for my first job. That's how I got my first job, was through an internship. It wasn't because I had finally received my diploma. I was available to work full time. So I would say, you know, one of the most important things you can do is get your foot in the door that way, and do internships if you can. And also just never hesitate to ask, and don't ever think that an opportunity isn't available to you because you don't think you're good enough to do it, or you just don't think you're qualified. It just always never hurts to ask.
Thank you. I'd like to thank all our panelists, if we give them a round of applause. Like to introduce our next speakers, Ann Chadwick Diaz and Margie Bergal. Ann and Margie are part of the web design group responsible for the design and development of our customer-facing websites like Fidelity.com. Ann and Margie work as accessibility and usability analysts. And in this role, they work with users of all abilities in the Usability Lab to learn how to improve the design of our website. They use what they learn in the lab in working with project teams to help develop new pages that are usable and accessible to the broadest range of users, including those who use assistive technologies. Ann and Margie are also proud members of the VIBUG, the Visually Impaired Blind Users Group. Please join me in welcoming Ann and Margie.
I'm Ann Chadwick Diaz.
And I'm Margie Bergal. We are in the web design group. So just for starters, the web for us is a really critical conduit by which we do business. For Fidelity.com, if you're an individual investor, you want to get a brokerage account, let's say you want to buy Google, you go to Fidelity.com and you open a brokerage account. And we have about 74 million folks who own accounts. So 74 million customer accounts, and we get just south of 3 million hits to that website a day. Over 95% of our commissionable trades occur online, so if you go and you buy Google, we actually take a little fee for that transaction, and that's a large way in which we generate revenue. So the web is incredibly important for us.
And so we need to make that accessible to everyone. How many folks here have trouble on the web? Some people, right? And so we have to fix that, don't we? That's kind of lucky that we get to do this for a living. So let's talk a little more about that.
So our role, so we sit within the design organization for a larger technology group. And what that means is we have been web designers in our former lives, but we don't necessarily design the pages that you might see on Fidelity.com. Instead, what we do is we bring in users, actual Fidelity.com customers, or even people who are thinking about becoming customers, and we bring them into our usability labs. Alicia had mentioned the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, or someone had mentioned it. That's downstairs on the third floor, and our lab is actually affiliated with that. We call it FCAT, that's its moniker. Its charter is to look at new and emerging technologies and ways that we can apply them to our business, basically 3 to 5 years out. So it's not 10 years, 20 years, highly conceptual research and development. It's really looking to see what the practical applications are. Our user experience or usability lab is a part of that larger division. And so folks will come in from outside and sit in a lab, one of three rooms of the lab. It's basically a simulated office environment.
So we have a deck. We're showing pictures now of the lab, and basically it shows a control room where we sit, and then another room where our customers come in and use our websites. We also have a room where the people who are designing that website watch people using their websites, and we call it the room of pain because they watch their perfect design not work so well often in that room. But it's really how we learn to make things usable and accessible. So we may think we know how to make a web page accessible to someone using JAWS, but guess what? We bring in someone using JAWS, and we didn't really know as much as we thought we did. And that's really what user experience professionals do, is they just work with customers to see if the designs that they're creating are actually usable to people.
And it's not always at the point when we have a prototype or a sample of the pages that we're ready to test. Sometimes we'll run focus groups and say, hey, you as customers, what do you want to see in the new research section on Fidelity.com? And so we'll solicit ideas that way that then get folded into the designs that we then test, but that's further downstream. And some of the things that we should add that we're looking for when customers come in to work with these prototypes, can they perform tasks that they want to do in real life, and can they be successful doing them? We're looking to see how long it takes them to perform these tasks, and any points of confusion, and then also we're asking them to talk out loud. So they might say, okay, well now I'm thinking, I'm looking for the contact us link. I'm going to bring up links list and type C to see if there's a contact us section, something of that nature. And if there isn't, or if something about our website departs from expectation, that's the kind of thing that we're going to know and we're going to communicate to the business team, as well as other subjective feedback that folks might like something or really hate something. And those are the kinds of comments that we're also going to bring back to the project team with intent to improve the design moving forward.
So Marty's pulled up a graph that shows something about metrics of our customers. So we like to know a lot about our customers, who's logging in and what are they doing. And there's a lot of stereotypes up there, so we have a question for you. In terms of age, who do you think is the most active customer on Fidelity.com? If you could pick an age that was the most active online of our customers, what age would it be?
And by most active, we mean logs on the most.
Goes on the most. Just say some numbers up there.
Yeah, just yell.
Who's the most active?
35.
I'd say between 20 and 40.
20 and 40. 35.
I'll say 50.
I'd say 50.
50.
Yeah, 55,
60. And no cheating if you can see the graph. If you can see the graph, I'm cheating.
Is there a guess?
There was a 70.
70?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
51 or 52.
51 or 52. Those are great guesses. Excellent guesses.
Cheryl, I'm sorry.
Oh, actually, I was just repeating Boyana's answer. Boyana, why did you say 70? Just a good number?
Yeah.
Good number?
Good number? It is a good number.
And it's the closest number. So in January 2010, the most active customer was 72. Okay, so people think, you know, it's 20-year-olds that are logging on, not the older folks. But guess what? A lot of older folks are logging on. And, you know, to Fidelity, they actually have the most money. And guess what they also have? They also have a lot of visual impairments and other types of impairments. So these are things that we really need to care about and think about when we're thinking about our user experience.
And it was actually under Anne's leadership that we launched an initiative maybe 6 years ago to look at the needs specifically of folks of retirement age and what their needs were online. And earlier on, 6-7 years ago, we brought folks in, and there was a really wide range of aptitude online. A lot of folks we found were less confident in their abilities, or they did what we call cautious clicking, where they positioned their mouse cursor over the link and then debate with themselves about whether or not they wanted to click it, because they feared getting off track or not being able to recover. For younger folks, everything was click, 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 back, back button, and everything is editable or you can undo. But older users tend to be a little bit more hesitant or a little more cautious in navigating the web. So one of the things we learned from the lab was that basically good design is just good design. So as a result of working with the older customers, we changed our links, the language that we had in links, to make it more active. So instead of exchanges, where you're going to move money from one account to another, we changed that link to move money. And guess what? Older folks did better. They were more successful in their tasks. It took less time to do their tasks. But it also ended up helping younger users. and users who were, you know, maybe in their 40s and 50s. So that's kind of the way we try to approach accessibility, is design solutions may be targeted to meet the needs of a particular demographic, but really done in a way that benefits everybody.
And that's called universal design, and it's something we really promote. So Marky's going to show you a video clip of a user session so you can get some understanding of what we do. And I think this is a video clip of someone who's blind, I'm not sure. But what we find is when we design things maybe to serve the needs of someone who's blind, guess what? Sometimes those solutions really help everyone. So that's what we mean when we say good design is just good design. It's good design for everyone.
Right, so this is a gentleman who came in. He's a JAWS user. If you're a customer, we have a feature on our accounts that allows you to pay bills. We call it Bill Pay. And we asked him to access a link that I think was Fidelity Bill Pay demo. And it basically launches a flash movie that he's then going to try to interact with.
So and what have your experiences been with Flash in terms of its accessibility online? Good or bad? Like a Flash movie?
Bad.
Bad. Has anybody ever heard Flash movie start, Flash movie end?
I have.
Yeah. Okay. Flash is a technology that they use on the web a lot for movies or demos. And a lot of times when you go to a JAWS, it will say Flash movie start, Flash movie end, and then you find out you can't really do much else with it. But there are people like Marky and I, and it could be you as well, who need to figure out how to make that player accessible to someone who is using assistive technology, or even to a search engine, or anything, any kind of technology that's accessing it. So
we're
going to play this video clip of a user session.
Yep, and we'll just play it for a few seconds just to give you a sense. So I'm actually sitting in the room with him, and we're kind of going through this experience together.
So I'll just ask you to explore what you find here, and I'd be interested in just hearing your thoughts.
Okay. Flash movie start, which doesn't usually start the movie sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
See, this is a robot. Oh, that's not bad. I've never heard that before. Oh, that's good. That's good. Now let's see if they work or not. I just want to go through a picture.
Yeah, okay.
Now, what's the difference between Flash Movie Star and Flash Movie Play?
Good question. I'm going to plead the fifth for now.
Okay.
And,
I'll go with the Play Movie. Okay. But actually, okay, good, all right.
There's a better way to pay your bills with Fidelity Bill Pay.
Okay, so we're going to stop it there.
Okay. The JAWS is kind of fast, I think.
Well, I agree.
Yeah.
JAWS is fast, yeah. Some people listen to it really fast.
And actually, it's an interesting thing that folks are mentioning right now. So when folks come into the lab, we want them to use work their assistive technology, if they're working with it, in the way that they normally would at home. Because our job is to get a sense for what they'd normally be doing or the way in which they really want to work with our pages. So we let folks come in and set up JAWS or Window Eyes or whatever it is to their liking. That was just something we do early on.
And then you also heard him ask a question, and you heard Marty say, well, I'm going to plead the fifth. As our jobs, we actually try not to answer any questions when someone's in the lab, because we want to see exactly what they do. We're not sitting next to them at home to tell them how to use that demo. So we don't really give them a lot of information. We just ask a lot of questions, and we listen very carefully. And then we try to take their feedback and incorporate it into the design.
Yeah, so it was a little tough to hear what was going on there. But basically, he heard zero button when the Flash movie launched. Maybe that's something that you've experienced yourselves. If Flash isn't tagged in the right way, it's not going to be accessible to screen readers. And there's also ways in which you can place it in a page that makes it accessible to screen readers. And if it's not placed in the page properly, you won't even hear a zero button. In some cases, you may not even know that there's Flash on the page at all. In this case, we were working with a demo that a developer was working on, and we just wanted to get feedback and see the level of accessibility. Anne and I, as a result of working with older users and then getting to do research with folks of all abilities and using various forms of assistive software, then decided we would try to build an initiative internally. Alicia talked about one earlier that she had been a part of maybe 8 years ago, and it did a great job, and then a sense is that it started to lose steam. So we thought we'd try to revive it. Fortunately, we were able to do it. We saw a need, and we were able to fill it. And now it means that we work with folks who are designing, developing, and testing our web pages to make sure that they're accessible, that they're meeting certain accessibility standards and guidelines that are advanced either by the federal government or by W3C, which is basically standards body. They're based in MIT, but they really have members from around the world, and their task is to advance accessibility guidelines that people like us can follow to make all of our content accessible to anybody, really.
Yeah, but we have a slide up now. Laws seem to be changing. I don't know if you've heard, but there's some legal action to make the Americans with Disabilities Act apply to the web. It doesn't now, but people believe it should, and it would mean that every company needed to make their website accessible, so we're very hopeful that that's going to happen.
And who knows what law got passed last week that Obama signed into law? Yeah, Bruce?
21st Century Communications Act.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's going to require, you know, smartphone user interfaces to be accessible, captions for online video, things of that nature. So it's definitely coming down the pike, and we're prepared. Yeah, question in the middle.
My class, in math class, do you know about the stock market game that students play, where
no.
they try to make the most money in their enterprises? Well, because of websites like you guys and I think that the way you don't use a lot of big, long words and lots of money talk, lots of, like, really big words and a lot, you know, it's good because you want to get a younger audience into buying and selling stocks, you know, and
right.
you don't want your audience to, you know, sort of, you know, go away. I think that's really cool that you guys sort of made it easier for people who maybe aren't the greatest with money and don't understand a lot of those big fancy words.
Actually, that's an excellent point. So you're right. We have spent a lot of time working with Generation Gen Y. So we've done a lot of FCAT, Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, does a lot of Gen Y research because, you know, they have different needs. So it's really, our job is really just about understanding the unique needs that everyone has, and everyone's different at every age, every part of their life. You know, your finances change as you age and your financial needs change. So.
And what you're talking about is sort of an established usability or user experience design principle, which is to use the user's language. Don't alienate them by using fancy verbiage. Rather, try to use plain language so that the broadest range of users can sort of understand.
The laws are changing, and there's a huge need out there, and everything's done on the web. So we really think there's going to be an increased need for accessibility specialists out there. And there really are. I mean, Marty and I get we're lucky enough to get to go to conferences like CSUN and so forth. So we meet people like Victor Sarin at Yahoo. He works as an accessibility specialist there. He's blind, and his wife is, I think, low vision and works there. Divya Raman at Google. And, you know, even have, we see these all the time. There's jobs posted on Monster. If you go into monster.com and type in the word accessibility, you'll find jobs for accessibility specialists. I think Brittany has one up now. Let's read some of the... Facebook is looking for an accessibility engineer. Let's read some of the requirements of that.
They're seeking an experienced user interface engineer, so user interface designer, engineer, user interaction designer. There are a lot of different names that the kind of work that we do might fall under, but in this case, they're using interface engineer. It's passionate about building accessible, user-facing web applications. It includes management of technical accessibility processes and ownership of over internal and external communication of Facebook's accessibility strategies.
So how many of you use Facebook, and how many want to see it improved in terms of its accessibility? So there's lots of hands, yeah.
So there are a lot of things that it lists in terms of responsibilities, but you'd be working with product teams to implement accessible products. You'd be participating in code reviews to make sure that the code was accessible. You'd be communicating accessibility best practices internally to the company, managing some of the processes around making things accessible, and then also talking about Facebook's accessibility strategy, both internally in the company and externally. Also, it lists a variety of responsibilities, but in this case, it's a fairly technical role, and that's actually something that Anne and I have gotten to sort of beef up on, is that when you're dealing with web technologies, a lot of accessibility lives at the code level. So there's a lot that happens in design with the kinds of colors you use or whether or not text can scale and the kinds of languages that you're using, but also to integrate well with JAWS or WindowEyes or Dragon Naturally Speaking, you want to make sure really that the code is sound. And so a lot of these positions are now starting to ask for HTML knowledge, scripting knowledge, knowledge around PDF, things of that nature. There's another description that we have up now. It's from Salesforce.com. They're out in San Francisco, and they're a big mover and shaker in the cloud computing space, which is becoming big. And they're looking for an experienced accessibility researcher to join their rapidly growing user experience team. Some of the responsibilities involve collaborating with UI designers, product managers, and developers to assess features for accessibility requirements and recommend solutions for any accessibility issues that you might find. logging and tracking accessibility issues in their internal database, advancing current processes and practices around evaluating tools, and just making them accessible overall. So we're starting to see that these on-job boards pop up more and more, and we only think it's going to increase given the way in which the laws are changing.
And it's really just about being a user experience specialist. This is that now accessibility is getting folded into that job role because, you know, you need to consider the needs of everyone. And now, you know, unfortunately, we think the laws are going to mandate it.
I wanted to ask, since you mentioned about something about smartphone, do you know about what Droid is? Does Droid have anything for people who are blind?
That's a good question. So the question was, does Droid have anything for people who are blind? And I believe they do. We were just reading about stuff that the iPhone makes available. But Droid, I know they released several apps that were supposed to help with wayfinding, but I haven't read more in depth about that. But we can do some research and let you know.
iPhone actually is doing quite a bit with making their application accessible. It's not fully accessible, their phone, but I haven't read a lot about Droid.
You said that most people online, some people that I know just use the old pencil and paper.
And that's actually an issue as well, in that a lot of older customers we might work with, they will come to the lab knowing that they're going to take part in a sort of web usability study, but they'll bring their paper statements. They printed them out, and those are the things they sit around the kitchen table with, really trying to plot a plan for their financial future. So absolutely, the print world is still very big, especially for the older demographic.
She asked if the Droid was accessible, but they do make phones that talk.
Yeah.
Like Ogo IT does, and Motorola makes a phone too. Like, that's what I use. You can tell me what numbers I'm dialing, and it's tell me if it's calling in that. You can tell me if I have a call from somebody on my speak dial, and say, call from this person.
And I would argue that that's good for everybody, because sometimes, you know, I'm sighted, but maybe I'm in the dark, or I don't necessarily, I'm driving, let's say. And that's the kind of information that I would want without necessarily having to look at the interface.
Right. I read an article today on iPhone accessibility, and so the iPhone can take a picture of a sunset and then tell you the colors that it sees. So it was an article about a blind person who felt like the iPhone was changing things for them because they could take a picture of the sunset and then talk to their mother about the colors of the sunset that evening. So, you know, it's really amazing what technology can do if we can make it accessible to folks.
What do you recommend for folks who aren't using Facebook? And does Facebook, three-part question. Part one, does Facebook work for the visually impaired? Part two, is there any cyberbullying on Facebook? And part three, what if Jaws only use Facebook? Are there other places like Skype? And what do you think of Skype?
Facebook is kind of accessible from what we hear, but not fully.
Well, why don't we ask the audience? How do folks feel about it?
I'm actually on Facebook.
It's all right. I mean, there's some things, like for me, I have some vision. It's kind of difficult for me to read some things. And then it's like, hard for me to find, like, stuff. And actually, the other day, I was just talking to someone. I was on Skype with someone, and I was also doing Facebook. And I was having trouble multitasking because I was getting really frustrated with Facebook. But for the most part, it's pretty accessible.
Cyberbullying, I think cyberbullying is happening. Bullying is happening everywhere. And I'm sure it does happen on Facebook as well, unfortunately.
If it's not accessible to JAWS, if you find that Facebook is not accessible to JAWS, what do you do? Oftentimes, there is a way to email the web manager or whatever they call it. But sometimes, and if you, or even just a contact us link, and if you can say, I'm a JAWS user, you know, and I'm unable to access this part of your application, and I find it really frustrating, to let me know, you know, how you're going to fix this, basically. Because I think companies are starting to get a sense for the fact that accessibility really is important, and they can't kind of just forget about it as, you know, the piece of requirement.
I mean, I guess that's why Facebook is hiring.
Yeah, right.
An accessibility specialist. Oh, and I wanted to say gaming, you know, wow, gaming is huge. So, you know, you learn how to program in the language that they're making games, and it's a really marketable skill. You don't have to be on the web. You just have to know how to create cool games.
You said how they're making everything accessible. Do you think that the video game companies and all that will start making accessible games for the blind and visually impaired?
Well, that's a good question. I know, actually, there's someone based in Boston who, and Cheryl, maybe you know him. I know he goes to Vibug every now and then, but he lives in Somerville, I think, and makes games specifically for everybody to play. But I think he tests with JAWS users as well.
And I think IBM was working on Second Life accessibility.
They had a research initiative. We're not sure if they were talking with Linden Labs
in the Second Life. I don't know, but that's a big game.
So there are folks who are looking into it. You could tag, let's say, various objects in a virtual reality that then JAWS might be able to pick up on. So, yeah, folks are working on it, but I'm not sure, from a practical perspective, how far away they are from actually implementing it so that you can enjoy it.
There are, screen readers on the Braille Note, which can do games and stuff that you could also do with, other games from, Blizzard or stuff like that.
Right, so you're saying some of the games don't work with your assistive technology?
I think they should, because...
They absolutely should.
And we have friends that play all these games, and we're not allowed to join in because we can't use them.
I think there's growing recognition that needs to be done. That said, I think there's a long way to go. So I think, you getting out there and being vocal or taking a real interest in how to do that could really make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And it never hurts to ask the question of a company. So if you encounter a game or an application that you want to access but you can't, then sending them a question about it, telling them a little bit about who you are, and then asking them, if they can help. At least it's going to make your voice heard, so they'll have it in the back of their mind, whether or not they're prepared to do anything about it. You think that's going to change over time, and folks are going to be basically beholden to laws.
In your experience, both with the job kind of job postings that you pointed out today and the conferences that you attend, do you feel that Fidelity is kind of out there by themselves and lead in a leadership kind of role in this whole accessibility for the website, or are you now getting a sense that more and more companies are doing it? And if they're doing it, are they doing it because they value it for their customers, or they're doing it because they feel they have to?
We actually have confidential information we can't share, because we do actually look at our competitors and see how they're doing with accessibility as compared to us. And I think, we probably were ahead there for a little bit, and I think we're doing it for the right reasons. But from our perspective, it looks like other companies are catching up, and I don't know why they're doing it. It could be because they see the laws changing. I don't know if you have something to add there.
Yeah, well, I will say that several years ago, 3 or 4, we were looking to hire a third person, because it's just Ann and I, and there are thousands of web pages on one website alone. And we went to accessibility conferences looking for someone with a particular skill set, and we couldn't find it. But now we're starting to see that more and more people have sort of at least basic HTML experience, web design experience, and some working knowledge of the web accessibility standards. So we're starting to see more folks sort of develop a skill set that could help a company like Fidelity, let's say, or a company like Bank of America or IBM. There are some companies like Hewlett-Packard, IBM, primarily technology companies, Google, Yahoo, that have devoted accessibility programs. So Victor Saren at Yahoo, he's the accessibility program manager. He's a JAWS user himself. At Google, Ann mentioned TV Ramen, and Charles Chen, do accessibility-specific stuff. So I think the technology companies are leading the way, but we're also starting to see, actually particularly financial companies as well, because I think they have a sense that their customer base is older and that, in some cases the laws are changing.
I think we were more out there on our own a few years ago. I don't think it's the case anymore. I think more and more companies, and we look at other companies' sites, and they're getting better and better. So someone's doing something. We're just lucky enough to talk about it more publicly, but a lot of companies, I think, even like the Bank of America, are doing a lot. They don't necessarily advertise it.
Talking about the 21st Century Accessibility Act, the students from Perkins this summer, they did a video chat with Congressman Markey. I was wondering if any of you guys, any of the students here that are here today, did remember that over the summer, actually talking to Congressman Sam, you remember that?
Yes,
I think there was an integral part that our Congressman was looking at in terms of asking our students the issues they had. So that was very exciting when that actually was signed by the President.
Yeah.
And in terms of just smartphones alone, I mean, it's such a huge needed thing for the students in terms of their overall independence.
Right.
Considering that now there are a lot of different applications for digital speech technology that are already applied, for example, in telephone menus, things like that, that allow for audio interpretive responses back from the user, is there anything like that that Fidelity is involved in or you see on the horizon for computer technology whereby as opposed to using JAWS, for example, there would be a digital audio technology, which is a virtual technology back, allowing the person to hear the question but not necessarily interpreted by JAWS, but also be able to respond in an audio format / digital format, so that if there are form fields to be filled in, they can respond auditorily, things like that. Is that anything that Fidelity's looked at yet?
So, Jonathan, just to clarify, so you mean that you could actually talk to the interface to input stuff, not necessarily using Dragon, naturally speaking?
Not necessarily Dragon in this case, but something that would be interactive. Is there any, there are various types of development programs and programs that are somewhat interactive, that are, you know, young, they're really not, there's not a lot of enhancements to them right now. But is there anything that Fidelity is looking at so that the user who is not necessarily a good typist, for example,
right,
or wants to go into a note screen or an email screen, something like that, can auditorily transmit their information through a speech product?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. A few years ago, the speech-to-text and text-to-speech was a really big area of research, but and FCAT looked at it, I think, but it really was always not good enough to work. I do think that Dragon is really getting out there for general use. And, you know, when it comes to preparing a web page for Dragon, Dragon can work as long as we make it accessible to anything. So all the things that we do to make our pages accessible to a screen reader will actually also help Dragon. I mean, I know it's not exactly the answer you're looking for, but no, I mean, I don't think we're doing, to my knowledge, I don't think we're doing anything with speech technology. I think people are thinking software like Dragon will handle that.
So the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology has certain projects afoot, and one is looking at virtual worlds, another is looking at biometrics, you know,
social media,
but I don't think audio input is one.
But I will add, I think that's the future. I think you're right. It's kind of like Star Trek. I do think that we're going to be, you know, within the next 10 years, we'll be talking to our computers as opposed to typing. I really do think that. But I think it's going to be the web page, and it's going to be software that's going to do it for us.
I wanted to go back to what was spoken about before about video games. I've noticed, as someone with a game like Halo, which if you don't know is a first-person shooter involving aliens, it actually has a handicap option where you can choose between three levels, no, some, or severe, or something of that sort, where it actually shows you with blue lines and things like that where things are, and it actually, when the monsters or whatever is coming towards you, it makes more noise, which I think is very helpful, because otherwise I wouldn't have been able to play that game with my brothers and wouldn't have been able to experience it. And I don't see why something like World of Warcraft can't be accessible. Rhythm games like Guitar Hero and online, if you guys have ever heard of Jam Legend, it's more underground now, but it should be more popular than it is. If you're someone who has some vision, it's very good. It can improve your hand-eye coordination, and it'd be really amazing if they could make a version of Guitar Hero or Rock Band for people with no vision, because a lot of blind and visually impaired people are very, very musically talented. I don't know about myself, but a lot of them are.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I hopefully the laws changing are going to require that of many things, and I think there's going to be opportunity for people to go out there and help make that happen, because I have to say, when we started this, people didn't know how to make the web accessible. You had to figure it out, and so you just had to figure it out yourselves. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity out there for someone who wants to figure that out and work with, you know, Margie and I aren't developers, but we work with developers, and we know what needs to happen, and so we work with them to make that page accessible. And I think the same thing can happen in gaming.
The other quick thing I'd add is that now that there's so many new applications and games and so forth, and there's more and more competition as well to sort of distinguish yourself from your competitors. So as that happens, I think companies look for any edge that they can get on their competition to provide a richer experience, to broaden their customer base in any way. And so I think accessibility will probably play a role in that, because what you described with Halo would probably help it make be a richer experience for me.
One of the questions I have a few students that I'm teaching banking and budgeting with. Some of them are not really adept at using JAWS. You know how well Duxbury would work with getting a statement out, a monthly statement in Braille. Is that possible to do that?
What's Duxbury?
It's a Braille in Boston program. Braille translation and embossing program. Okay. Could it take a statement that you get online and translate it into Braille?
I don't know if that's possible, but I do know that there are certain banks, Bank of America specifically, right off the top, that claim to offer Braille statements and large print statements as well. It's something we've looked into as well. But as far as the translation goes,
do you offer Braille statements?
At the current time, we don't, unfortunately.
That was what my question for her, because I do a lot of her banking. Would she be able to go online? Because she is sighted, but she's very low vision. Would she be able to go online and, you know, pay her own bills, pay the cable bill and her bowling fees and her for a food bill and stuff?
Through Fidelity.com or just the web in general?
Yes, well, with the site, with the
website. We hope so. So one of the things that we fought for forever was to make our web pages, make the text get larger when you change the settings in Internet Explorer, let's say. Now our pages do that, so they do get quite large. Just for you all to know, like, getting those changes inside a large corporation takes a lot of work. It took many, many years to, you know, get the company to see that. But yes, I think, you know, we have offered large print statements as well on request.
Right, upon request, yeah.
So, Anne and Margie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, that concludes today. What do you think? Did you have fun?
Yeah.
Should we try and put something together?
We can. Yeah,
we can.
Sure.
Yeah, all right. So we'll figure that out. We'll something else. All right. Bert is up in the booth, so he's been our producer. You guys. Thank you. I want to thank our panelists. I think most of them had to leave to get back to their job. I want to thank Anne and Margie. They were great. Everybody from Perkins and from our place, our space, and from Carol. And am I missing anybody? No?
Mass Commission,
yes, thank you very much. And I want to thank Cheryl Cummings, who really made this possible. Thank you, Cheryl. And Fidelity's Leanne Bonner. She really put all the logistics together, the communications, the food, the Community Relations Department, thank you so much for coming. This was a great day. I learned so much from each and every one of you. And honestly, please call me, email me. Let's stay in touch, and we will try and pull something together this spring. Thank you, everybody.